Before we start with the lecture of Professor Pöppel, let me start with a short introduction. This is just for background. First of all, I would like to introduce myself. My name is Stefanie Firin. I studied theater and cultural studies. And just by chance, I came to the Museum for Natural History, the Museum für Naturkunde here in Berlin, where I was responsible for the marketing and event management during the last years. And by now, I'm working there for the history of science in the collections, and I look at the scientific collections as a cultural heritage. I have to say, this museum is far more than a museum. It is a scientific institution with more than 70 scientists who are working as, who are doing fundamental research, and these in all fields of the nature. Our collections belong to the biggest collections in the world, with more than 30 million objects. Yes, we have enough things laying around. We just celebrated our jubilee of 200 years. Unfortunately, I was asked a bit late, so that your program was stuffed and there was no slot of time to visit the museum for all of you or the collections. And because of that, I prepared these pictures that you have an impression what this house has in its collections. And when I prepared this yesterday, I thought, hey, to be honest, nature is the biggest artist and our scientists are a sort of curators. And indeed, the scientists are called curator in English, and in German it's Kustode. But in English the word is curator, and these people are responsible for a specific collection. Okay, but now to the theme. When I was here at the discussion on Tuesday evening, I listened to Bernd Scherer and the others on the panel and learned that artists are different. They have another way of looking on things. And this seems to differ an artist from a scientist. And I learned that artists describe the world. They create new worlds. Artists create new languages. They find new ways for communication. And artists always try to find new ways of knowledge. They want to go beyond. And that scientists need the artists because of their subjectivity. But then I thought, hey, what else are my colleagues are doing? Especially those who are doing fundamental research. This is especially the mission of taxonomy, and classification. And the function of taxonomy, I'm not sure if you know, all of you know this, is to describe species, to establish and to name organisms in order to come to a hierarchical system of the nature and to give an order to the nature. And, well, yes, because scientists, they also describe the world. They create new worlds. Scientists give name to things, which is the precondition for their communication. And scientists indeed need intuition and creativity to find the characteristic signs of a new species in order to identify it. They need a talent to identify these special signs. And even so, in the so-called exact science of nature, the basic ideas of interpretations are based on subjectivity. And sensual approach is required when transferring the nature in our concepts of thinking. To sum up, The scientific world and the world of art is not a long way away from each other. They have the same basis, abstraction, and describing the world. I wonder, is the method of reducing the complexness of a central resource of thinking? Is intuition something that belongs to the art or also the scientific work? Is it possible that the structure of perception or the brain forces us into a frame of science and art? To answer these questions, we need a specialist. And I'm very happy that the Synapse team has invited Professor Ernst Pöppel, whose main field is neuroscience, like cognitive research, like neuropsychology, like sensory physiology. And from this point of view, from his point of view, he looks on the arts and communicates with the arts and the artists and the curators. Before his emeritation, he was a director of the Institute of Medical Psychology at the University at Munich. During his career, it seems that Ernst Pöppel has held each position one could dream of as a neuroscientist. He had fellowships in different Max Planck institutes, was a scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the MIT. He was a member of the board of directors at the Research Center in Jülich. He is chairman of the Human Science Center in Munich, as well as chairman or director at other scientific institute or programs, like the Generation Research Program. His scientific work was honored with various awards, medals, and memberships, like the Deutsche Akademie der Naturforscher Leopoldina. I could continue with other achievements of Ernst Pöppel or his enormous number of publications, but I want to come to an end. With his idea of interdisciplinarity and internationality, with his interest in neuroaesthetics, that is the biological aspects of the arts, and the neuroscientific foundations of aesthetics, he is the right person for Synapse. Let's hear what he can tell us about the links between art and science.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for the introduction. If you tell these stories about a person, you are always a little bit afraid, of course. it's always a challenge. And actually, for me, it's a dream to be in this building. It's a very famous building, Schwangere Auster. And it's the first time I've been in the building. But I walked across here many times. I should also say that English is not my first language. You hear that already. I have a wonderful German accent, I've been told. And sometimes I have word-finding difficulties, but because at 10 o'clock in the morning, it's very difficult for me to give a talk, because I'm a victim of the circadian cycle, the chronobiology, my internal clock. So I'm still in the process of waking up. So please help me if I have some stuck. I would like to talk a little bit about the relationship between art, and not only, let's say, pictorial art, but art in general. And I give a few examples about poetry and music and paintings. And somehow the challenge is to link these two fields. Now, the first challenge is which button I have to press. Let's try this one, okay. Traditionally, starting with British empiricism and also René Descartes, We think that the content of what we have in our mind and the brain is determined by stimuli S on the left side, which our sensory systems process. And this is some kind of traditional view. It's actually interesting, it's the same view defined by John Locke and by the rationalist René Descartes. All of you still know their Latin, nihil est in intellectu, quid non ante fuerit in sensu. Nothing is in the mind which was not before in the senses. But then Leibniz came along and said, well, nihil intellectus ipse, but the mind itself, it's in the mind to somehow process what we have in our consciousness. But on this traditional view, the stimuli processed, psychologists often think about the brain like this box, the square, and it comes to R. R stands for three things. It's the representation of the world, it is a reaction to stimuli, and actually it stands also for a reflection about the world. So triple R. And we look at this as a bottom-up process. So we are victims of our sensory information that we pick up. And well, perhaps the most important topic today would be that this may be not correct. And one thing, as university professors, we have to teach our students. I come from a medical faculty, by the way. Medical students are certainly not the brightest in the world. And so they never understand what is the difference between necessary and sufficient. So the stimuli, a necessary condition to have information in our consciousness, but maybe it's not sufficient. So let's. What I would want to do, I want to go through some kind of experimental observations, perhaps. But first, going back to René Descartes again. This comes actually from Descartes, and the question here is how pain is represented. And here the idea is that stimuli, this fire on the left side on the bottom, results in the stimulation of receptor C fibers, for instance, which are transferred in the spine and then come to send a signal to the brain, and then we sense pain. But everybody knows that pain, the intensity of pain, is also dependent on the situation we are in. There's a famous German football player, a soccer player, for those who come from the States, who actually broke his finger in a game. And he did not realize that. After the game, he felt the pain. So the condition somehow suppressed the pain representation. There's a famous theory, the gate control theory of pain perception. I realize you discussed before also some observations by Ramachandran how to control pain. So, but this may not be true then. So maybe we construct our world we see. And here, now let's start with the first experiment. Please don't move your eyes and look at the little black dot in the center. For 10 seconds, and don't move your eyes. And now you move over to the white dot. And what you probably will see is that you have some kind of superimposition of an image which was created by fatigue of receptors in your eye. Now look back to the black dot, and if you 10 seconds again, and then when you look back again, tilt your head a little bit to the side. Well, you look there. Now you do another experiment. Look at the black dot in the center, and you focus now your attention while looking at this to the crossing points of the others, the sort of the streets. And what you observe probably will be that they are a little bit darker than this. When you look over, then they are brighter again. So what you actually can do, you can disentangle the visual axis from the attention axis. And when you do that, you can observe that something is
strange going on. I'm not going into detail. We can discuss it in private. It's a lateral inhibition in the retina and the eye itself that is responsible for this effect. This is actually an effect which was used in op art, and probably you know this famous picture by Vasarely, which uses actually this information processing in the retina and the eye itself and creates an image which has much more information than actually which is physically given. Let's have another experiment. Look again at this, to the black little dot, left side up there. 10 seconds, don't move your eyes. And now you look back down there to the right, and you will probably see a complementary color in the frame, but now it has already disappeared, a reddish center. Where we had white, we have red. Now look at the center of the right. Actually, you do not have something like a stick here or something like a, I think so. Anyway. Now, let's 10 seconds again to this little dot there in the blue, and then you look down, and what you see is a yellowish frame. What does? Yeah. Okay, so look here, and then you look down, and what you probably see is a bluish center. Can I have some kind of a nodding? Is that so? Yeah. Okay, so have it a little bit more interactive. Now, look over here, and what you can create, look here, 10 seconds again, and you can predict already what's going to happen. And you look over here, then you have the complementary colors in the frame and gray in the center. So you have somehow a superimposition of the different colors creating gray. Actually, it's a reversed Newtonian experiment, which he did in optics many years ago. There's something else you can see. When you look at the laser pointer, yeah, you see that I'm trembling. The laser pointer is one of the most stupid inventions ever done by young, right-handed engineers, male engineers, who do what they can do, but they do not somehow recognize that you cannot anticipate where I'm going to move now. Yeah? You cannot, but a real stick, yeah? Like in Star Wars, in Obi-Wan Kenobi, yeah? With a laser pointer, there you can, the eye can follow. With a laser pointer, you cannot. The only thing you see is that I'm trembling, okay? So it's another kind of interaction. So in a way, it's strange that we create a color where the mechanism again is related to how we construct color. And there's who's interested in the retinex theory by Edwin Land, founder of Polaroid. Colors are constructed in the brain. Colors are not the passive reflections of what we process in our eye. And details maybe later. Another example now. What do we actually see when we look around? And it's interesting for me as a scientist, a neuroscientist, that Malevich, is one of these icons in our tradition, suprematism, created a concept that actually he shows there what we see when we somehow do not address our attention to the objects, but to what could be the info, what is the surface which is processed, is it is simply surfaces, areas, and edges, nothing else, and maybe holes. So this is a topological approach to visual perception, which is a big fight right now in our field between Chinese colleagues who think the primary aspect of visual processing is topological invariance, is surfaces, edges, holes. And let's say the Anglo-American approach, and this is sort of my approach, that we disentangle, we create details and then put them together in order to create central percepts. So Malevich somehow anticipated a theory of perception we have right now in our research. And this is somehow for me surprising and somehow also satisfying that artists often invent and discover something we scientists reinvent then usually a little later. That is sort of in many fields we can show that. So now a cartoon here. So then come to the next point. Is that all you can say? It's not messy. So the attitude you may have to certain aspects of op art, for instance. Now let's move to the next point, brains. Where does it all happen? Now, the human brain, this is a picture I always show in my talks, which comes from Munich, which is sort of in every textbook of psychology and neuroscience. Brodmann discovered it. On the right side, it's a visual area, it's back here. Frontal area, 40% of the brain, which makes us human perhaps, and other areas. What we have to see here is one thing, that different areas of the brain process different kind of information. So it could be different. It could be some kind of homogeneous thing like the liver, and things are processed only algorithmically in some homogeneous area. It's not true. We have dedication of certain functions to different areas of the brain. But now comes again the problem of necessary and sufficient. The activity of certain area is necessary to have conscious perception, for instance, but it's not sufficient. It's the spatial-temporal pattern of activities which is necessary to create content. And this is actually the big, big challenge right now in the neurosciences. Using imaging technology like functional magnetic resonance imaging, positron emission tomography, or MEG, which we do here in Berlin, actually, that looking in detail at the spatial-temporal patterns, given a certain cognitive activity, when you listen, in case you listen, you have not just an activity somewhere in the auditory brain, but it's a distribution of activities, and to somehow describe this mathematically, that's the challenge of science. I think that may go beyond the artist's interests, but I think somehow an artist knows probably that there is no percept which is not embedded in emotion evaluation, in memory concept, and all that. So that is sort of Brodmann, and now let's look into the brain itself and how information is processed. This was we have about 100 billion nerve cells, maybe it's even more, maybe 500 billion. So in some textbooks they say 12 billion. Well, this is wrong. The cerebellum, das Kleinhirn, has already 100 billion nerve cells. And these are unique entities, independent, these are cells, independent. And the big question then is from a philosophical point is, how is it possible that a machinery, a brain, creates a unity of percept, a unity of experience, of reasoning, of emotions, in a network where the elements are completely related only with each other by synapses. The synapses are sort of the machinery to create and to have informational flow between these different nerve cells. Now, how does this, how is this possibly reflected in the arts? Well, you probably know this icon again from Jackson Pollock. That somehow it reminds us that somehow this could be like in a brain distributed activities. By the way, it is again a cartoon from the New Yorker. It is impossible to copy Jackson Pollock. Yeah, and that is quite interesting, that when we think about how to copy something, we need structure, we need elements somehow which are semantically defined, and we cannot copy some irregular patterns. This is nice to have a little baby here. I have 8 grandchildren, by the way. Okay, now let's look in the machinery. This and the next slide are perhaps the most important if you want to understand brain processing on a very abstract level. And if we understand this, and you come into discussion, in case you are not a brain scientist, let's say you are a psychologist, a politician, or business person, you always know better. So you are, some gives you the, what is it in German, die Meinungshoheit an Stammtischen der Wissenschaften, or so, the leading opinion about. Okay, so let's try. It takes a few minutes to explain this. All brains that ever have been developed, and much more than you have in your museum, have the identical structure. Organisms are around here on this globe since almost 4 billion years, but brains are around since 700, 800 million years. The average life expectancy of a species is about 2 million years. That's not so much. So we know then already that 99.99% of all organisms have disappeared again. So we are just some kind of temporal island, we here. By the way, if humankind would disappear from an evolutionary point of view, who cares? Yeah? We are here around some time, and now we do everything maybe to survive. But from a special point of view, from outside point of view, we are nothing special. But we do, of course, science to extend our species' life expectancy. So what is it sort of, what is the characteristic of these brains? All brains have only three types of nerve cells: sensory cells, sinus cells, receptors on the left. And these are the antenna which somehow reach into the world. So we see all organisms, the eyes have been developed at least 20 times independently in evolution, all organisms see between, let's say, 350 to 800 nanometer. We listen, or we can hear, let's say, from 20 to 20,000 hertz. But we are, when I say this, we are practically blind for most of the world in the infrared and ultraviolet region. We do not hear anything lower than 20 hertz or beyond 20,000 hertz. So the access to the world, the antenna of the world, are extremely limited, grenzen, limits of consciousness. And somehow what we always do, we try to present which is not visible into this area of seeing, wahrnehmen. In German, it's very nice. Wahrnehmen ist für wahrnehmen. Wahrnehmen, to perceive, has something to do with truth. Somehow, it's the effortless processing of information gives us some kind of direct access to the world, and we believe in it. That is sort of, we do not question what we see. We open our eyes, and this effortless processing is somehow directly, quickly accepted. So we have about 500 million of those. Then we have the third type of motorische Zellen, motor neurons. This is the output of the brain, about 2 million only in humans, that we can move, speak, show our emotions and all that. And then we have the great intermediate net in between. And this is the same in all organisms, but in evolution, it has been developed in a different way. And we know three things about this great intermediate net, which is the brain, basically. One is the architecture. What is the construction of this architecture, the morphology? Well, every circle represents here one nerve cell. And we know that every nerve cell sends information to roughly 10,000 others, divergence of information processing. Divergence. Well, for geometric reasons, then we have convergence. Every nerve cell gets input from about 10,000 other neurons. Now, a little mathematical game, if every input to a nerve cell is independent of each other and we have 10,000 inputs, how many possible functional states does a nerve cell have? Well, 2 to the power 10,000 minus 1, that is 10 to the 3,000, so a 1 with 3,000 zeros. That's a lot. Yeah? Physicists tell me there are just 10 to the 82, power 82 particles in the universe. So in other words, there are so many possible brain states, in one functional states in one nerve cell, that in principle, I would say, it is impossible to compute in a precise way the state of a nerve cell. We are unberechenbar. It's not computable. And in German, we have this unberechenbar in a double sense. This is why we are unberechenbar. Yeah, it's impossible to clearly say in what state we are in. So this is because of the anatomy. Number two, what we should know is, what is the language between nerve cells? Well, these are neurotransmitters. If one nerve cell is active, then another one can be active, so it's excitation, or another one can be reduced in its activity. So we have Hemmung is inhibition, next one is inhibited, or Erregung, excitation. So this is the neurotransmitters, the chemical transmitters that somehow represent the language of our brain. And there's some kind of equilibrium of excitation and inhibition. And in the next slide, I'll explain what the consequences might be. And then number three, and this is from a philosophical, psychological point of view, maybe the most important. We ask ourselves now, how far away are any nerve cells from each other, so that they can influence the next one? So one of the 100 million, 100 billion is active. How many in between have to be activated, inhibited, or excited, that this local information is present anywhere else in the brain? And the answer is 4 intermediate steps. So although we have 100 billion, only 4 times you can come from one point to another in the brain. And that means there's an unbelievable closeness of information processing. And this has a following consequence. Nothing can be conceived of as being independent in the brain. There is no percept which can be independent of an emotional evaluation. And there is no memory which can be independent of a volition or a percept. These terms we use in science, but also in general public life, consciousness, perception, emotion, memory, these are all inventions by, let's say, philosophers. Starts all with Parmenides 2,500 years ago, then with Plato, all that. We are somehow in the language trap. We believe in the entity. The essentialism comes from there. But from the brain point of view, we always have to look at the process. And we cannot, we need these words to somehow communicate, but we should not believe that there's a site of intelligence, a site of consciousness, a site of emotions. This is only in the newspapers like Süddeutsche Zeitung or New York Times and all that, that there's somehow areas that represent religion or buying or something like that. That's all nonsense. So we have to, because of the relationship, the very close relationship with all this. So this, I think, a philosophical point. We have to understand there's no independence of seeing from other areas. There's no independence. It's all somehow related. And the question is, how? And I think here it's quite clear, of course. I know quite a few artist friends. This is where we talk to each other. Yeah? That is, we would make a mistake when we think this is all. We can look only at the, let's say, attention systems. That does not exist. Now, as this, Scherer, this is also dedicated to diseases, die Gesundheit. And this little slide explains, I hope, in an abstract level, the possible problems brains can have. One should know that 1/3 of all the money we spend in all developed countries is dedicated to deal with problems of brains, the brain, which, by the way, in Germany is 100 billion euro every year. So where can we have problems? Well, we can have problems at the input, Sinneszellen. Yeah? You see that A. For instance, in retinitis pigmentosa, we lose our ganglion cells. Suddenly, we cannot see anymore. Yeah? And this is a big problem. And now with technology development, how can we enhance this? What can we do with retina implants or something like that? B, see output. We can have a problem in the output. Like ALS is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Yeah, Stephen Hawking, the famous physicist, has this disease. You have a functional brain, but you cannot reach your muscles anymore. So that's one problem. What have we? Number C. So C down there, it relates. We always have a balance between excitation and inhibition within a circumscribed area of the brain. And in diseases like epilepsy, or Parkinson, or schizophrenia, or depression, we have a disbalance between these different neurotransmitters. In Parkinson, for instance, you cannot initiate a movement anymore because you are lacking an inhibitory transmitter so that you cannot start a movement or you cannot express emotions in your face. That is, so the, and we'll call it the medication, of course, is the drug companies somehow survive in a certain sense by developing drugs here to create or recreate a balance. Number D refers to, well, the problem that we may lose nerve cells all over the place. And this is Alzheimer's disease or alcoholism. We lose nerve cells in areas of the brain, usually in the parietal and temporal lobe. By the way, Klammer auf. You know that alcohol is a poison, yeah? And it destroys nerve cells. But which ones? Well, the bad ones. So moderate alcohol consumption results in higher intelligence. And there are actually studies that show that people who drink not at all and who drink at much too much have a lower mental competence compared to who have moderate. So I happen to be actually also a member of the scientific committee of the German Wine Academy. And so that is actually a scientific result.